A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been thinking about the indispensable leader pattern, the founder or senior exec who's become the single trunk for every decision, and he makes a useful cut right at the start. There's the ego-driven version, the person who genuinely believes nobody else can make the right call. But then there's the other flavor, the one who says, look, I'd love to delegate, but nobody else knows the procedures. The vendor contacts, the deployment sequences, the regulatory filing steps. That person might actually be open to a fix.
And that distinction matters enormously, because the first type is a personality problem. The second type is an institutional knowledge problem. One of those has a structural solution.
Which is what Daniel's really asking about. Can you take a leader who's become a bottleneck, not because they need to be the hero, but because they're the only person who knows how things work, and externalize that knowledge into something the whole organization can use?
The short answer is yes. The longer answer involves something called reverse documentation, and it's not just a theory. There's actual research on this, and we're going to walk through exactly how it works, why naive write, it down mandates fail, and what a real knowledge transfer project looks like in practice.
The founder, who's the only person who knows the AWS root password, the vendor escalation path, and the quarterly filing deadline all at once. That's not a leader. That's a single point of failure with a title.
The hopeful part, which I think is what Daniel's getting at, is that if the bottleneck is about knowledge and not about ego, you can transform that person from a choke point into a force multiplier. You just need the right method.
Let's get into it. Let's define this pattern properly, because I think a lot of people have worked under it without having a name for it. The indispensable leader isn't necessarily a bad manager in the conventional sense. They might be perfectly reasonable to work with day to day.
And that's what makes it confusing. You can have a founder who's supportive, who listens, who doesn't micromanage, and yet the organization still grinds to a halt whenever they're out sick. Because they're the only person who knows the vendor escalation path, the regulatory filing calendar, the deployment sequence. It's not about personality, it's about knowledge concentration.
The knowledge concentration usually happens for perfectly legitimate reasons. Early stage company, three people in a room. The founder does everything because there is no one else. Then you hire, you grow, but the habits don't scale. Nobody ever sat down and said, right, now we need to transfer the vendor relationships and the compliance procedures and the deployment pipeline to other people.
The clinical analogy would be a surgeon who's still doing their own patient intake and billing, because that's how it worked when they opened a solo practice. At some point, you need to build systems around the expertise, or the expertise becomes the bottleneck.
Which brings us to the distinction Daniel made, the ego-driven variant. The person who believes nobody else can make the right decision, that's a different animal entirely. That person doesn't want to transfer knowledge, because their identity is wrapped up in being the decider. But the knowledge-hoarding variant, they might actually be relieved if someone offered them a workable way out.
That's the key insight. The knowledge-hoarding leader often knows they're the bottleneck. They feel it every day. They're drowning in escalations, they can't take a vacation, they're answering Slack messages from the hospital waiting room. They want out. They just don't know how to get out without dropping everything on the floor.
The diagnosis matters. If you're dealing with the ego case, you have a leadership problem that probably requires board-level intervention. If you're dealing with the knowledge case, you have an institutional memory problem. And institutional memory problems have structural solutions.
Which is where reverse documentation enters the picture. But before we get to the fix, I want to sit with the problem for one more minute, because there's a hidden cost here that most people miss. It's not just throughput, it's fragility.
The bus factor.
The bus factor. If your bus factor is 1, meaning one person getting hit by a bus would take down critical workflows, you don't have an organization. You have a dependency graph with a single point of failure. And what's insidious about the knowledge hoarding variant is that the leader doesn't want the bus factor to be 1. They're not hoarding power. They're hoarding context that nobody else has had the time or structure to absorb.
The standard corporate response to this is, let's do a documentation sprint. Everybody write down what they know, which fails almost every time, for reasons we'll get into.
It fails because the knowledge is tacit. It's embedded in relationships, in muscle memory, in the 5-minute sidebar conversation that happened 3 years ago and was never written down. Asking someone to just type up what they know is like asking a jazz musician to write out their improvisation as sheet music after the fact. They can do it, sort of, but what you get is a pale shadow of the actual performance.
The thesis Daniel's putting forward, and I think he's right, is that this is fundamentally solvable. Not easy, but solvable. The knowledge hoarding leader isn't a lost cause. They're a documentation project waiting to happen.
The method that actually works flips the entire model on its head. Instead of asking the leader to document, you send someone to extract the knowledge from them. That's the reverse in reverse documentation.
Which sounds almost too simple, but we'll get into why the research backs it up and how it plays out in practice.
Let's do that.
Let's trace how this actually happens, because nobody sets out to become the bottleneck. Early stage company, you're shipping product, you're the one who set up the AWS account, you're the one who negotiated the vendor contracts, you're the one who knows the 3 things that will break if you deploy on a Thursday. And that's fine when there are 5 of you.
Then you're 20 people, then 40, then 120. And nobody ever scheduled the meeting where the founder sits down and transfers the deployment pipeline to someone else. It's not malice, it's not ego. It's just that the urgency of shipping always beats the importance of documenting.
The knowledge gets deeper and more entangled over time. It's not just the steps, it's the judgment calls. We don't use the standard API endpoint for this vendor because of an outage in 2022 that never got written up. We file the regulatory paperwork in this order because the reviewer in Frankfurt prefers it that way. That stuff lives in one person's head.
The Stack Overflow Developer Survey from 2023 found that 42% of developers cite knowledge silos as a top productivity blocker. That's not a niche problem. That's nearly half the industry saying I can't get my work done because the information I need is locked in someone else's brain.
The hidden cost isn't just slower throughput, it's that the organization is one bad flu season away from a crisis. The indispensable leader gets appendicitis, and suddenly nobody can push to production. Nobody knows the escalation path for the payment processor. Nobody knows which regulatory filing is due next Tuesday.
That's the bus factor. The concept originated in software engineering in the late 90s. The minimum number of team members who, if hit by a bus, would cause the project to fail. In these organizations, the bus factor is 1. And what's grimly funny is that the leader usually knows it. They're the ones lying in the hospital bed trying to answer Slack messages.
The company tries the obvious fix. They announce a documentation initiative. Everybody needs to write down their procedures. And it fails, almost universally.
It fails for 3 reasons. First, the leader is too busy. They're already the bottleneck, so asking them to spend 20 hours writing documentation is absurd. Second, the knowledge is tacit. It's not a list of steps they can just type out. It's context, it's relationships, it's the thing they know to check when the error message looks vaguely familiar. Third, documentation is seen as overhead, not as product. It's the thing you do when the real work is done, and the real work is never done.
I've seen the output of those initiatives. You get a 3-page document that says things like, configure the server appropriately and run the deployment script. It's worse than nothing, because it gives the illusion that the knowledge has been transferred.
Nanaka's SECI model from 1995, socialization, externalization, combination, internalization, is the classic framework for how knowledge moves in organizations. And what most documentation pushes try to do is jump straight to externalization. The expert sits down and writes. But Nonaka's whole point is that tacit knowledge doesn't externalize that way. You need a socialization phase first. Someone needs to observe, absorb, ask questions.
Which is exactly what reverse documentation does. Instead of asking the leader to write, you assign someone to shadow them. A dedicated documentarian who watches the deployment, records the commands, asks why are we using this flag instead of that one, and then writes it up. The leader's job isn't to document, it's to be observed and to validate.
There's a case study I keep coming back to. 40-person SaaS company, the CTO was the only person who could deploy to production. The deployment pipeline was this elaborate 4-hour ritual that only he understood. They assigned a junior engineer to shadow him for 2 weeks. Every deployment she sat next to him recorded every command, every decision, every what-if-this-fails contingency. At the end of 2 weeks, she had a runbook.
What happened to deployment time?
Went from 4 hours with the CTO to 45 minutes with any engineer on the team. Not because the junior engineer was a genius, because the knowledge that had been locked in one person's muscle memory was now a document that anyone could follow, and the CTO got 2 weeks of his life back.
That's the thing. The leader in that story wasn't resisting. He just didn't have a method. The moment someone showed up with a structured way to extract what he knew, he was relieved.
That's the core of why reverse documentation works, where write it down fails. You're not asking the bottleneck to also be the documentarian. You're treating the leader's knowledge as a resource to be mined, and you're sending in someone whose entire job is the mining. The leader just has to show up and answer questions for 30 minutes a day.
We've got the method. But what does the research actually say? Because it's one thing to have a nice case study about a CTO and a junior engineer. It's another to know whether this holds up systematically.
There's a 2024 study by Argut and Ferenkoff in Organization Science that looked at exactly this, knowledge transfer in expert-led organizations. They compared structured shadowing plus validation cycles against self-documentation mandates, the write-it-down approach. The shadowing approach was 3 times more effective.
3 times more effective at what, exactly?
At producing documentation that another person could actually use to complete the procedure successfully on their first attempt. Not just at producing more pages. Usable knowledge transfer. And the validation cycle was the critical piece. The documentarian writes it up, the expert reviews it, catches the errors, fills in the gaps. That back and forth is where the tacit stuff surfaces.
Which maps directly onto Nonika's SECI model. The shadowing is the socialization phase. The documentarian absorbs the context by watching. The write-up is externalization, turning tacit knowledge into explicit knowledge. The validation session is combination. The expert and the documentarian reconcile what was captured against what was meant.
Then internalization happens when someone else picks up the runbook and actually runs the deployment. That's the full cycle. Most companies try to skip straight to externalization and wonder why it doesn't work.
The academic grounding is solid, but the question Daniel's really asking is, how do you actually get the leader to cooperate? They're busy, they might feel threatened, they might believe the knowledge is too complex to transfer.
The framing matters enormously. If you walk in and say we need to document everything you know so the company can survive without you, that lands as a threat, even if it's true. The better framing is, we want to scale your impact. Right now, your expertise is bottlenecked through your calendar. If we externalize it, your knowledge can be applied even when you're not in the room.
That's not spin. It's what happens. The CTO in that case study didn't lose status. He got his evenings back.
The second strategy is, start with low-stakes procedures. Don't lead with the production deployment pipeline or the regulatory filing that could get the company fined. Start with something like the new vendor onboarding checklist. Something where, if the documentation has a gap, the consequences are minor. It builds trust in the process.
The third one, which I think is underrated, is to make the documentation a deliverable for a specific project, not a side initiative, not a nice-to-have. The deployment pipeline documentation is a deliverable of the infrastructure scaling project, with a deadline and an owner.
That's how you bypass the "it's overhead" objection. Documentation as overhead is documentation that never gets written. Documentation as a project deliverable is documentation that ships.
There's also the harder case. The leader who says this is too complex, you can't possibly capture it, there are too many edge cases. Which is sometimes true, but usually it's fear dressed up as expertise.
The hardware startup example is instructive here. Lead engineer, PCB design process. They asked him to document it. He wrote 3 pages. It was useless. Basically a list of tool preferences and don't forget to check the tolerances. No one could reproduce his workflow from it. Then they assigned a technical writer to shadow him for a week. She asked the questions he didn't think to answer. Why do you run the thermal simulation before the signal integrity check? What tells you this trace needs to be wider? 30 pages later, they had a guide that actually worked.
The knowledge was transferable. He just wasn't the right person to do the transferring. He was the expert, not the documentarian. Those are different skills.
That's the point. The leader doesn't need to be good at documentation. They need to be willing to be shadowed and to spend 30 minutes a day validating what the documentarian produces. That's the whole ask.
Let's talk about what happens after. Once the knowledge is externalized, the organization can actually start to question and improve the procedures. The wiki becomes a living artifact. Someone reads the deployment rem book and says, "Wait, why are we doing this step manually? That's automatable."
This is where the real transformation happens. The shift from hero culture to engineering culture. In hero culture, knowledge lives in people, and the person who knows the most has the most power. In engineering culture, knowledge lives in systems, and the system gets better over time because anyone can propose an improvement.
The FinTech case study makes this concrete. 200-person company. Compliance officer was the only person who knew the regulatory filing process. 4 months of reverse documentation produced a 47-page compliance playbook. But the bigger win was what happened next. Once the process was visible, the team found redundancies. They found steps that had been necessary 3 years ago, but weren't anymore. Filing errors dropped by 80%. Not because the compliance officer got better at their job, but because the process itself became improvable.
That's the knock-on effect that nobody talks about. Documentation isn't just insurance against the bus. It's the prerequisite for optimization. You can't improve a process you can't see.
Now, the objection that always comes up at this point is security. What about vendor pricing? You can't just put everything in a wiki.
The Federation problem. And it's a legitimate concern. The answer is tiered access. You don't need one wiki with one permission level. You have a public wiki for general procedures. How to deploy, how to onboard a vendor, how to file the quarterly paperwork. You have restricted pages for sensitive material, vendor pricing, customer PII handling procedures. And you have a secrets manager like HashiCorp Vault for credentials. Nobody needs the AWS root password in a wiki page.
The goal isn't total transparency. It's documented transparency. Everyone should know what they don't have access to and why. The runbook says, authenticate via Vault. Fetch the deployment credentials. The credentials themselves live in Vault, with audit logging and access controls.
That's actually better than the status quo, where the credentials live in the CTO's head and a sticky note on their monitor. At least Vault tells you who accessed what and when.
The final piece is what happens to the leader. This is a genuine identity shift. They go from being the decider to being the validator. They don't make every call anymore. They review and approve the documentation that enables other people to make the calls.
That takes time. The research and the case studies suggest 3 to 6 months of consistent practice before it feels natural. The leader has to learn that their value isn't in being the only person who knows. It's in being the person who built the system that knows.
Which is a harder identity to hold, initially. But it's the only one that scales. The theory and the case studies point to a clear pattern. Let me give you something concrete. Because I think a lot of people listening are sitting in organizations where the bus factor is 1 and they know it. Here's the 4-step process.
Step 1. Identify the top 3 knowledge bottlenecks. Where is the bus factor exactly 1? Not where it's inconvenient, but where the organization stops if one person is unavailable. Production deployments, regulatory filings, key vendor relationships. You're looking for the procedures where no backup exists.
You'll know you've found one because the answer to who else can do this is either nobody or, well, Sarah kind of watched me do it once.
Step 2, assign a documentarian to each bottleneck. And this is the part most people get wrong. The documentarian is not the leader. It's someone else. A junior engineer, a technical writer, a PM who's curious and methodical. Their entire job for 2 to 4 weeks is to shadow the expert, record every step, ask every obvious question.
The obvious questions are the important ones. The expert has forgotten what's obvious. They'll skip the step they do automatically, and that's the step that breaks when someone else tries to follow the runbook.
Step 3, the validation cycle, 30 minutes a day. The documentarian brings the draft to the expert. The expert reads it, catches the gaps, says no, you do this before that, not after. This is where the tacit knowledge surfaces, because the expert sees the written version and realizes what's missing.
30 minutes is the magic number. It's short enough that the busy leader can actually commit to it. It's long enough to get through a meaningful chunk. If you ask for a 2-hour review session, it'll never happen.
Step 4, publish to a wiki with tiered access and schedule quarterly reviews. The quarterly review is critical because procedures rot, the vendor changes their API, the regulatory filing deadline moves. The wiki has to be a living document, not a time capsule.
You need a metric. Otherwise, it's just a good intention. I'd propose documentation coverage. What percentage of your critical procedures have a runbook that someone other than the original expert can actually execute, end to end, without asking for help?
Target 80% within 6 months. Not 100% because some things are edge cases, but 80% of your critical path documented means the organization can survive a bus. It means the leader can take a vacation without a satellite phone.
The mindset shift is the part that doesn't fit in the checklist. Every leader in one of these organizations should ask themselves a single question. If I were hit by a bus tomorrow, could the team keep running for a week? Just keep the lights on and the customer served.
If the answer is no, reverse documentation is not a nice to have. It's not a professional development exercise. It's a fiduciary responsibility. To the company, to the investors, to the team whose livelihoods depend on the organization not being one person away from collapse.
That's the framing that cuts through the busyness objection. You're not too busy to document. You're too busy not to document. Every hour you spend transferring knowledge returns 10 hours of not being the bottleneck.
There's one more thing I want to flag, because it's the diagnostic that tells you which variant you're dealing with. You try reverse documentation. You frame it as scaling their impact. You start with a low-stakes procedure. You assign a documentarian. You ask for 30 minutes a day.
They say no.
If they say no 3 times, after 3 different attempts with 3 different framings, you are not dealing with the knowledge-hoarding variant. You are dealing with the ego-driven variant. The person whose identity is wrapped up in being indispensable.
That's when the intervention changes. It's no longer a documentation project. It's a leadership problem that requires coaching, board pressure, or replacement. The 3 strikes rule is important because it keeps you from wasting 6 months trying to document someone who doesn't want to be documented.
The knowledge-hoarding leader will be relieved. The ego-driven leader will be threatened. The difference becomes obvious very quickly.
The ego-driven case is tragic, because the person usually has tremendous expertise that the organization needs. But if they won't externalize it, they're not an asset. They're a hostage-taker. One forward-looking question, though. The tools are getting better fast. Automated meeting transcription, process mining, AI that watches your screen and builds documentation from your workflow. Does reverse documentation eventually become automated? Does the human documentarian get replaced by software?
I think the capture layer gets automated, sure. An AI can watch a deployment and generate a draft runbook. It can transcribe the validation session. But the trust layer, the part where the leader sits down and says, no, that's not quite right. Here's what I actually check when that error appears. That's human. Validation is a relationship, not a transcript.
Because the leader has to trust that the documentarian, human or AI, captured the intent, not just the steps. And the documentarian has to trust that the leader isn't editing out the embarrassing parts.
The tooling will compress the shadowing phase. What took 2 weeks might take 2 days. But the 30-minute validation session with the actual expert, I don't see that going away. That's where the knowledge actually transfers, not just from brain to document, but from person to person.
The method holds. The indispensable leader is a failure of process, not a failure of character, but only if they're willing to externalize what they know. The ones who won't are the ones you need to worry about.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1930s, linguists studying Slovene discovered that the dual number, a grammatical form used specifically for exactly 2 of something, behaves like an optical property. It disappears when you're not looking directly at it. Speakers use it correctly in careful speech, but lose it entirely in rapid conversation, as though the grammatical category only exists under conscious observation.
Slovene grammar is quantum. This has been my Weird Prompts. If you enjoyed this, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps. We'll be back next week. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.